My name is Dee Bechtel, and this is a workshop entitled Sanctuary. And maybe the question that Norm asked after dinner in regard to the title shouldn't have an or in it. It's definitely civil disobedience and ministry, and it depends upon which one of those you're more interested in or how you want to combine those two things. But those two things, civil disobedience and ministry, are definitely in tension in this topic. We're going to take off a bit from the presentation that happened here at 4 o'clock this afternoon. How many of you were here at 4 o'clock and heard Chuck's presentation? Okay, so many of us have a background then about what some of the Central American questions are all about. I'll tell you in advance, so you can leave early if you want to, that my political position is considerably more radical than Chuck's. Now, I don't know if that's because I may not have as much to lose in being radical in this situation or what, but, you'll find out more about that as you go along, I guess. Also, I should probably declare to you up front that I'm not a Lutheran. They really do let people who are not Lutherans teach here. Don't shout it around too loudly, I want to stay. But the Lutheran Church and the Presbyterian Church, which is the tradition that I come from, are both part of many churches working together in through various agencies, one of which is the Religious Task Force on Central America. There are others where our churches combine their efforts as in combination with other churches in order to combine our ministry. The question of civil disobedience didn't begin in 1960 with people burning their draft cards. I think sometimes we don't think about the fact that civil disobedience has been with us for a long time. The first writings that I'm familiar with about civil disobedience came from Thoreau's essay on civil disobedience, which was published in 1848. He was protesting against the Mexican-American War, and he, as a matter of fact, refused to pay taxes in support of that war and went to jail until somebody paid his taxes for him and he was released from jail. But it was that context. He was protesting against that war as well as slavery, and he was willing to do some civil disobedience to draw attention to his cause. Sanctuary is also part of an ancient tradition. In Numbers 35 and in Joshua 20, the Bible talks to us about cities that were set apart, that were places of sanctuary. The Bible tells us that they were specifically designed to be for people who had committed accidental murder, or who at least contended that the murder that they had committed was accidental. Maybe that's a contradiction in terms. The killing that they had committed was accidental. And they could flee to one of these cities and get refuge from the vengeance that was the common way of settling those kinds of questions at that time, and have their case decided by the ruler of that city as to whether the killing really was accidental or not. This concept then came down to us, and during the Middle Ages, particularly in Europe, was reformed a bit into the concept that churches were holy places. And so if a person was on the lam from the law, in whatever capacity, you could go to a church and not be arrested. The idea was that the church was the place of God, where God's law ruled, and so therefore you could get sanctuary, a place of refuge from the law of the day, the civil law. I think it's interesting that many of us call the rooms where we go to worship on Sunday morning sanctuaries without thinking about where that word came from. The sanctuary movement is, in our country, similar to what the Underground Railroad was during Civil War times. And I assume most of you are familiar with that term. It was the way people on the lam from the law, generally slaves, got to Canada by means of the help of many people in churches and people who were against slavery and wanted to help people escape from slavery and get to Canada where they could get asylum. Currently, sanctuary is very similar to that, in that one of the purposes of the sanctuary movement in our nation today is to allow safe havens for people to get them from one church to another on their way to Canada. Canada will allow people from Central America asylum. They will allow them to stay in their country because Canada considers these people from Central America political refugees. The official position of our government is that these people are economic refugees. That's a term that Immigration and Naturalization Service has come up with. Basically, what they're talking about is Mexicans. Mexicans are economic refugees in terms of INS. They're here for economic reasons, according to INS. And INS now makes no distinction between people from Central America and people from Mexico or any other place that our government doesn't officially consider that there's a war on in those countries, or that those people are being oppressed by their own government or by forces that are at work in their countries. The position of the people in the sanctuary movement is definitely that there is a war on in Central America. I find it hard to believe that anybody doesn't know there's a war on, but maybe our government doesn't know that yet. So the position of the people in the sanctuary movement is that these people from Central America are fleeing for their lives. And I'll point out some more specific examples to demonstrate that in a few minutes. What I'm trying to do now is kind of give you a general overview, and I'll get into some more specifics that have been given to me by people who have been to Central America and who are also assisting with the sanctuary movement here. But in general, the facts of the matter are that many people who are deported by Immigration and Naturalization Service are killed very shortly after they return back home in their own countries. And although we have no proof of it, we suspect that the passenger manifests from the airplanes that these people are transported back to their home countries are specific, particularly El Salvador. The Salvadoran government simply takes the passenger manifests from these plane loads of people that are arriving in their country, Salvadoran citizens who are being deported from the United States, and uses those as hit lists. Now that's a rather terrifying thing when you are a person who is on one of those hit lists. Everybody is guessing at the numbers of people who from, well, and I'll speak specifically of El Salvador because that's the source of most of my information. As a matter of fact, I met a few months ago one of the nuns who was a personal friend of one of the four church workers who were killed in El Salvador. And so I suspect that what she had to say was rather authoritative. She estimates that there are probably 500,000 refugees from Central America who have entered the United States within the last year. These people have been denied refugee status or asylum of any sort here. They are illegals here, and the position of our government is that they ought to be returned to their homeland. As a matter of fact, I believe that I heard, and I don't know the statistics, but someone mentioned recently at Holden, someone was announcing about the collection that we are taking here is going to Guatemala, and they were saying that what I recall is something like 2/3 of the medical workers there have had to leave because of the violence in their country. These kinds of things also say that there's a war going on there. As a matter of fact, this nun. Her name is Sister Antonia Shedlow, and she knows of a specific instance whereby a person from El Salvador was denied asylum here, even though they tried to go through the proper channels through Immigration and Naturalization Service, because she had a letter in her possession that testified, you know, was witness to the violence that was going on in her homeland, and she was trying to use that as proof to show INS why she should be considered other than an economic refugee, why they should consider that she was a political refugee in our country. INS denied her asylum status because that letter wasn't notarized. That's the kind of attitude that we're dealing with from our government. INS is representing us, folks. That makes me angry. Some of the material I have I want to pass around because I want you to see some of the pictures in these documents. These are people that we're dealing with, and these are people whose lives are in jeopardy. So please pass some of these things around. I've also put up my War is Not Healthy poster, and this is my War is Not Healthy poster that I wear around all the time. That's a real important statement at this point. Pass some of these other things around as well. But there are some books that give us information about what the sanctuary movement is all about. This one is called Seeking Safe Haven, and it's a congregational guide to helping Central American refugees in the United States. It's published primarily by the American Friends Service Committee, but it's also other groups who have cooperated in the publishing of it are Church World Service, the Interreligious Task Force on El Salvador and Central America, and Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services. So this is... Thank you, I didn't know that. That's wonderful. Right. It is an excellent guide because it takes you step by step through the process about inform yourself, then what can you do after you realize there is a problem, specifically how you can help move your congregation toward assisting in the sanctuary movement. And if you're not ready to take the step, if your congregation is not quite ready to declare yourselves a sanctuary, and I'll get into more of the definition of that, then there's some suggestions in there about other things you can do. This is also a good resource, and I don't know if this one is in the bookstore or not. It's called Sanctuary and Justice Ministry, which I think is also an interesting comment on after following Chuck's presentation yesterday about mercy and justice. At least it's the attitude of this book that sanctuary is part of the justice that we ought to be concerned with. This gives a personal story. And again, I think it's important that we realize that these are people. These are human beings that we're talking about. The fact that their skins may be darker brown than some of ours, or that they come from a country that we don't identify with a whole lot because they're not Northern Europeans, doesn't belie the fact that they really are people. They are our brothers and sisters in Christ. Many of them are active in the church in their country. And those are some of the problems, those are some of the reasons why they're being persecuted. This is the case of Santana Chirino Amaya. Santana Chirino Amaya was one of the more than 25,000 Salvadoran refugees returned to El Salvador by the United States Immigration and Naturalization Service in the last 2 years. I believe this was written in 1982. He is also among the 30,000 Salvadorans who have lost their lives as a consequence of indiscriminate repression waged against the Salvadoran people. Mr. Amaya came to the United States in 1976, seeking the liberty and justice this country purportedly promises to all and which were denied him in El Salvador. A little comment on that. I also have an editorial cartoon that shows this huge wall with an American flag and USA printed on it, And there's a loudspeaker on the top, and it says, "Attention, huddled masses yearning to breathe free. Please keep your tired and poor. Just send your slave labor." This was in the press shortly after the defeat of the, well, excuse me, the passage of the Simpson-Mazzoli Act. And I'll talk about that a little bit more later, too. Like the majority of the 500,000 Salvadorans currently residing in the U.S., and again, that's an estimate, Mr. Amaya did not flee at gunpoint, but instead came in search of refuge from a political system which denied him his basic economic and social rights to live and work in a free society. For this reason, these hundreds of thousands of Salvadorans have been cast as, quote, economic refugees, as opposed to, quote, political refugees by the State Department, and are thus considered as, quote, excludables by the United States Immigration and Naturalization Service, as opposed to the thousands of Cuban returnables who have recently arrived at our shores. I'll skip a bit here, but basically the story of Mr. Amaya is that after he came here in 1976 and was returned to his country because he was here illegally, but he'd been here since 1976, and it was, I believe, about 4 years later that he was returned to his country. He was found brutally tortured and decapitated alongside a 14-year-old boy only 1 month after having been deported for the second time by the United States immigration officials. It goes on to say that they assume the reason why he was on this particularly dangerous road of death, is what they call it, which people in the country generally know that it's a very dangerous place to be, and why he was there with this young boy was because he'd been out of the country for such a long time that he didn't realize what the unwritten rules were in his part of the country at that time, and that he had also then endangered the life, probably unknowingly, of this young boy. The point is that it says, had he been accustomed to living in a war-torn society, the chances are that he would have known better than to choose such an unfortunate route. Mr. Amaya's story is not unusual. Sister Antonia Shedlow says that about 1,000 people a month are sent back to El Salvador. They're put on planes and returned to their homeland, and then approximately one-third of these are killed. The passenger manifests are turned over to the Salvadoran authorities, and somehow these people disappear. Our State Department has the power to order our Immigration Service to grant what's called extended voluntary departure status to these refugees. That's the status that has been granted to people from Indochina, been granted to other refugees who have come to our country seeking safe haven. It doesn't grant these people permanent status, that's another status, but simply allows them to remain here on a temporary basis. The idea is that they can stay here until it's safe to return to their own countries. Sister Shedlow also says that martyrdom has become a way of life in Central America. According to her, there are more Christians martyred in El Salvador. There have been more Christians martyred in El Salvador than in the first three centuries of the church. There are literally mass murders going on in El Salvador, and it's more dramatic in El Salvador, but this kind of thing is happening in other areas of Central America as well. One answer that we can give to this, this question of sanctuary plus others are talked about in what I've seen as Exhibit D, called Human Law and the Conscience of Believers, which was part of reports of, I believe it's the ALC, a statement commended to the 1984 General Convention of the American Lutheran Church for adoption And it goes on to give this report in its entirety. I understand that those reports are also available through some national church offices. Basically, this paper talks about the whole question of conscientious objection. It sets out the kind of guidelines by which the church has always considered conscientious objection a valid status or a valid position for believers to take. It sets up some guidelines, for instance, or it calls them principles. These are basically the standard under which the church says, yes, conscientious objection to the law is a valid stance. That you consider it only as a last resort. In other words, you've tried changing the law. If you consider a certain law invalid, then you've gone through other routes to try to change it, and you consider civil disobedience then as kind of a last resort. You do it only by nonviolent means. The church isn't condoning violence in any way. Well, in civil disobedience questions, I guess. That's rather a broad statement. That it be always for the sake of the larger community. You're not talking about simply a personal problem with the law, but you're doing it as a statement for the larger community. Always done with respect for the consciences of those who disagree. And this paper is very careful to point out that there may be people within individual congregations who disagree sharply on the question of whether civil disobedience ought to be the stand of those people. We always have to do it in respect to those people whose views may be different from ours. And always done with a willingness to accept the legal consequences. This would be brought out, and maybe some of you have been reading in the papers about the person who was, and I'm not sure what church she was from, but it was part of the sanctuary movement in Texas, where this person was arrested and convicted for, I don't know, harboring a fugitive perhaps, or something like that. This person was convicted of a crime because she was driving a car which was transporting Central American refugees, apparently from one church to another or from some stopping places along this Underground Railroad system. She has done this. This person has said, yes, I'm willing to pay the price. And I think if we're considering being part of the sanctuary movement at all, we have to be willing to say, yes, we are breaking the law, and we acknowledge that there are valid reasons of conscience why we're breaking the law, but we think it's important to do that. Right. As far that was the same status when I entered the village too, and I don't know if she has been sentenced or if that will make the national press.
No, she has not. I think it's scheduled for July, the sentencing. And the maximum penalty is 15 years. But the speculation is that she will get a very light sentence because it's the first time that this kind of case has been prosecuted by INS, and that they're trying to make an example and maybe even a suspended sentence, but we don't know yet.
Yeah.
The maximum is 15 years.
But I would suspect that it's like the draft resistor cases or the draft registration resistor cases, that people have been objecting to that and making known their objection, allowing themselves to be the examples that are held out in the press. Those people then, in the draft resistor cases, those people have gotten rather substantial penalties. I would suspect that this church worker driving the car won't be sentenced to anything near 15 years. I would guess more a suspended sentence too, but again, it's up to the judge. The thing that I guess strikes fear in the hearts of people involved in the sanctuary movement is that up until that time, there had been no one that the INS had really gone after for being involved in the sanctuary movement. People in churches could feel rather safe because we could say, yes, we are publicly making this statement to our community that we consider the immigration status of these people a bad law, and we're objecting to it, but there wasn't any real penalty that was hanging out there. Now there is, and we know that INS has the capacity to punish us for this if they want to do that.
And there's another case pending in Arizona.
Same kind of
church
thing
workers,
for
yeah,
transporting people?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And now, I mentioned earlier the Simpson-Mazzoli Act. That's the recent act that has passed both houses of our National Congress now, but in different form, and so it's a question now, we'll go to conference committee as to what the final end result of that process will be. But basically what that law does is penalizes employers for employing illegal aliens. It makes it the employer's job to check on the immigration status of people before they hire them, because employers are now going to be penalized for hiring illegal aliens. I live and work in an agricultural community where there is a lot of need for seasonal harvesting labor, and the employers there are really up in arms because they're saying, hey, it's not fair to us to make us the policemen for INS, which is basically what that law is doing. They're also saying that they have a need of seasonal farm workers and that they are unlikely to be able to get that kind of labor from other sources, or at least in the quantities that they need. But the end result of Simpson-Mazzoli is clearly going to be that illegal aliens are going to have a great deal more trouble in this country, because there are going to be more people that are going to be hesitant about giving them sanctuary or refuge. There are going to be more penalties involved. The good thing that, well, maybe the good thing that Simpson-Mazzoli did was to grant amnesty to those illegal aliens who were here since 1982. Nobody really knows how many people that is talking about.
Prior to me, isn't it? Who were here as of.
Oh, excuse me, right, yes.
Here
yes,
as of
I said that, all right. Yes, I said that incorrectly, right. Anyway, nobody knows how many people we're talking about in that case, because there are obviously large numbers of them that are being sent back to Central America, at least, and obviously a lot of people being bused back to Mexico all the time. So if you have to prove that you were here before a certain date, it gets real difficult to prove, I think. Okay, into the sanctuary movement itself. As I said before, it's based on this principle that the church is a holy place, a safe place where people can find refuge. And that idea has been extended to places that are kind of under the arms of the church. These people don't actually have to stay. You don't have to consider having a family actually housed in your church building necessarily, at least perhaps only for a short period of time, and these books give you some more guidelines about that. But usually that's the pattern, that a family of Salvadorans or people from Central America will come and stay in your church building for maybe a week or two until housing can be found for them elsewhere in the community and they feel somewhat safe. One of the important parts of this is that your church is willing to make a public statement. The reason for the civil disobedience is to draw attention to the fact that these are unjust laws that are being enforced in our country. And so what has been done most of the time, there have been press conferences held, and you may have seen these in some of your local papers, that say, you know, we have this family here. Sometimes they are shown with bags over their heads or their identities disguised in some way, so that they can't be traced as easily back to their home country. But you make a public statement, and you also involve your congregation in writing congresspeople, writing the Attorney General of the United States, writing Immigration and Naturalization Service to say, this is what our congregation has prayerfully decided to do. It is the decision of our congregation that we are doing this because we believe God's justice is more important than the, quote, justice of the INS, basically, is what it comes down to. And so you're making a public statement to draw attention to the fact that the law is unjust, which was one of the criteria then for the traditional civil disobedience things, and you're trying to get the law changed in the meantime. As I said before, the State Department now has the capacity to simply declare amnesty on all these people. They can say all refugees from Central America are political refugees. They are here because they are fleeing war, they are fleeing physical violence and death in their own countries, and so therefore they may stay here on as a temporary matter. Some of the concerns of people in the congregations have been, well, we don't want these people to be here forever, like we see the people from Indochina being here forever, or, you know, they're using taking jobs that should be jobs given to Americans, and those sorts of people. Speaking of Americans as people from the United States, which is somewhat a narrow view, in my opinion. They're from Central America. They are Americans, too, after all. The fact is that most of the people from El Salvador or Central America in general would like nothing better than to return to their homeland. They are freezing up here, for one thing. They don't really like our climate. There aren't very many jobs for them to have. You know, they are uncomfortable being out of their own homeland, and they really see their stay here as a very temporary one as well. They want, as quickly as possible, to return to their homelands. They just want a safe refuge for the time being. Now, some of them, and again, they're individuals, they're people. So some of them, want more than to stay in any city in the United States. They want to make their way to Canada via the Underground Railroad kind of system that I spoke about before. That's a possibility, and again, people in the sanctuary movement are assisting in that kind of movement as well. But what the sanctuary situation is all about is that we really are providing a safe haven for people who are fleeing for their lives, like Santano Amaya, for example. And I'm sure people who have been to Central America and seen people like Chuck, who've seen the refugee camps and those kinds of things, can tell you that the refugee camps outside their own country aren't very pleasant places. And so they're looking for some place that where they can get more of a safe haven.
Is our government worried about the fact that if they announce amnesty, then the economic people who want to come solely for economic reasons would flood the country? How do you distinguish?
Well, you distinguish, and there are rules and regulations set up for that now. This provision for a temporary stay is available to people where our government agrees that the government of their country, namely El Salvador in this case, is oppressing the people. As Chuck mentioned in his presentation at 4 o'clock, our government is not in a position to do that at the moment because we are supporting that government that is oppressing people in El Salvador. And so we can't with one arm of our government say, yes, these people are being oppressed by their government, are being killed by their government, and in the other hand, dishing out all this military and economic aid to their government. So it's a kind of a catch-22 for our government because we have to admit either that we have been wrong in what we've been doing in El Salvador or that these people really do have a right to be there. So that's the problem. It's easy to make a distinction. I mean, we can easily say there's no war going on in Mexico. And that doesn't, you know, if we gave this status then to refugees from El Salvador, we wouldn't have to give it to refugees from Mexico. We could just simply say, all you have to show is that you are from El Salvador and you will be accepted, much like the Indochinese refugees were accepted.
Well, what then about Honduras, Nicaragua, and all over?
At the moment, or at least my understanding, now I haven't been to Central America, and maybe Chuck and others could speak more specifically on that, but my understanding is that the situation is not as violent in Honduras or Nicaragua as it is in El Salvador. Now, again, I haven't been there firsthand and I don't know, but the people that I've talked to have been concerned with the El Salvador situation. Did you have some comment on that?
I would agree. El Salvador has a very serious civil war going on. Guatemala has one too. There are a lot of, especially indigenous people, Indians, being killed in Guatemala. Honduras has much less. I mean, there's really not a well-organized guerrilla movement in Honduras. And Nicaragua has been quite placid since the revolution, since the triumph of the revolution. There is no continuing war in Nicaragua. There is along the borders, but not within the country for the most part. So El Salvador is the focus right now of real violence, and Guatemala to a lesser degree.
Which countries do I take?
That's El Salvador.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, and that's where there were elections held recently.
Yeah.
I'd like to open it up for questions. Do you have questions generally about the sanctuary movement or about the church's position on civil disobedience or anything? What do you want to say? Yes?
I don't know why this question never occurred to me before, but it seems to me our government has given sanctuary to the refugees from Nicaragua who were wealthy people who fled with their money.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Yeah. And also,
and from Cuba.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't have a lot of information about the history of these struggles in Central America in general, but my understanding of some of the further back history was that it was because of economic interests that the United States had, mostly through fruit growers in some of these areas, that was our main interest in these countries in the first place. I mean, we're just talking about bucks ruling foreign policy in this situation. That's the bottom line. That's where a lot of this conflict came from.
Well, we called them sort of pejoratively banana republics.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Who was getting
time.
The bananas?
Honduras especially has had a lot of American fruit company presence. Costa Rica and Nicaragua to a lesser extent, but Honduras is still pretty dominated in its employment picture by fruit companies from the U.S.
Yes.
I'm sure that a congregation considering offering it itself as a place of sanctuary should be well informed about the possible penalties to them as a congregation. Could you say a bit about that?
I can't tell you specifics, you know, like what the maximum penalty is for violation of these laws, etc. And at the moment, it's kind of an unknown quantity specifically what you would be facing in terms of how long you could go to jail for transporting a person, those kinds of things. But congregations, of course, need to be aware that they are violating federal law when they provide sanctuary for refugees, or at least undocumented aliens.
And they do it as a corporation.
That's right. That's right. And that's one of the risks, that you're risking perhaps at least a portion of your tax-exempt status. Because if you're seen, you know, that isn't, breaking the law is not considered by the IRS to be a valid reason for a tax-exempt status. And so you need to, that's one of the penalties that could happen to your church, that you would be putting at jeopardy at least a portion of your tax-exempt status. But I think more realistically, you're really talking about prosecution by the Immigration and Naturalization Service for breaking federal laws, harboring a fugitive, those kinds of things. Yes.
We have a National Lutheran Campus Ministry. We just had a 3 or 4 page kind of legal opinion put out by our national office on it all. And one thing they said, that one would need a roll call vote in names, you know, of who said yes and who said no, so that, you know, just in case they want to go after somebody, they go after the people who voted yes, and not the people who voted no. Which is interesting. And the one thing that makes this whole issue very interesting to me is that on like individual action of civil disobedience, this is a corporate act. This is a community act of civil disobedience.
Yeah.
It makes it fascinating or scary or whatever, depending on where you stand.
That would make it, the roll call vote business would make it more scary for those people who were really putting their neck on the line. More so than making it, this is a corporate decision. This body, this congregation voted, and not publicizing, you know, who voted aye or nay. I find it interesting, as a matter of fact, if I can be so cheeky, is to compare the Presbyterian stance officially by the National Church with at least what the ALC was that I read in these reports. The ALC says, what's the terminology they use here? I'll find it in a minute. The American Lutheran Church promises to remain in ministry with those who have seriously, with those who, having seriously reviewed all the points above, make decisions of Christian conscience to undertake actions of civil disobedience. That's kind of getting the National Church off the hook, in my opinion. It's saying, you know, hey, local congregation, if you want to put your neck on the line, that's fine, but we as a national church are very carefully not putting our neck on the line. In contrast, the Presbyterians say they, this is the General Assembly, the national body, national convention, commends the congregation that have become places of sanctuary for Central American refugees and encourages synods, presbyteries, and congregations to follow their example. That's more putting the national church's neck on the line to a greater degree than I hear the wording of the ALC. I don't know what that's worth, because I doubt if the INS is going to prosecute the either the ALC or the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church. But what I read in that is that there is more encouragement and more support from the national body for a congregation who really puts its neck on the line a bit.
I think that's a valid conclusion. I think it also needs to be said, however, as you were indicating, that sanctuary really can only be done by a local community of Christians. National church bodies can't do sanctuary. At least I haven't figured out how they can do it. It has to be a local group, a locale. And so the ALC statement, the paper which is going to the convention this fall, says that congregations which choose to do sanctuary ought to enter it very carefully, and it recommends that they do it by consensus, not by a majority vote of 51 or even 2/3 or 3/4, because that's a sure prescription for splitting a congregation, it seems to us. That do it by consensus, and I think most of the sanctuary congregations have done it that way. That is, it's either been unanimous or nobody has objected.
Yeah.
One definition of consensus.
And there are some other steps, and I think those books point out rather carefully that if your congregation is not one that is ready to take that very bold step of saying, hey, INS, we are defying your laws, you can do other things. You can assist another congregation, and I'm sure most of our cities have congregations that have decided to be places of sanctuary. What the rest of us can do is provide economic support, help provide clothing and food or whatever these families need as they come through. You can be in ministry with a congregation who is providing sanctuary without actually being the sanctuary yourself. And I think that would be a very helpful step, but is a less courageous step if that's what your congregation may be ready for at that point. There are other things that you can do. For instance, just simply start a letter writing campaign to officials in the government, including your own Congress representatives, to say, hey, we think that these laws are bad, or the way we are, our current policy is bad toward these refugees and ought to be changed. Please use your influence to get it changed. Yes.
In regard to writing on Congressman Angus, I don't think I have enough info to say that the law is bad. It's really the interpretation of the law
that's
that we're in trouble.
Yes,
right?
It's
the implementation of the law.
It's not necessarily the law itself. So if you're writing your letter, you might want to make
Right, okay, right. We could say certainly that the present treatment of refugees from El Salvador is not what our, what I, and perhaps if you're speaking for your congregation, considers to be just, and is not the position that our country ought to be taking toward these people. You can certainly say that. And that's a very powerful tool. I think most of us don't realize how, what an impact our letters to our congressional representatives or our state representatives have. They really do pay attention to those, and most of the time, my experience is that they respond. Yes.
I wondered if this has just changed significantly, the policy has changed significantly in the last 4 years, if that was in the Reagan administration, if this stronger hard line towards Central American refugees has been occurring, or
well, it's hard to say, really, because the situation in El Salvador, as far as I know. Oh, sure. I'll give you my permission to get mad at the Reagan administration about a whole lot of other things, including this. But really, the situation in El Salvador 4 years ago was not as severe as it is now. That has been escalating during this administration. So I'm not sure that we can lay all the blame at Reagan's foot, although he certainly has the power to change it. Yes.
I guess I want to direct the question back to Chuck. Are you really saying that do you believe this too, if I heard you right, that consensus about such issues is where the church should be at, otherwise it might be divisive in the congregation, and that what rules is whether or not an issue is divisive or not?
No, I would say before a congregation, I would say this, I did say it in my own congregation, before a congregation decides to do civil disobedience as a collectivity, I'm not talking about individuals who choose to do civil disobedience, but before a congregation corporately decides to do an act of civil disobedience, there ought to be more than a 51% majority for it, or there's going to be real trouble. I think that congregation is going to split apart into two congregations if they do it on a 51% majority.
But you also add two-thirds.
Well, where to, how far do you go? Yeah. It seems to me the consensus model that Quakers use is a very useful model for this kind of decision, rather than a majority, a two-thirds majority, or whatever. But a congregation is free to decide how it wants to do it. I think the campus ministry suggestion that people with a written ballot say vote yes or no, that may be one way to do it. I just think it would be unwise in the congregation I presently belong to if we decide to do sanctuary on a two-thirds majority vote.
On the other side, the net result, if they follow the guidance of the national office, that nobody would end up, I don't have that much faith in the congregation that they could reach a consensus on this issue.
Well, there are some that have. There are over 100 now that have declared public sanctuary.
ALC churches?
Oh, no.
No,
I'm
talking
100 of all kinds.
Yeah.
About, I think, 7 or 8 Lutheran churches. But I also think, as Drew was saying, there are a lot of other things short of sanctuary that we can do and ought to be doing. And some need to do sanctuary, I think, to make that public witness. But there are a lot of other things short of that we can do within the law. There are 16 or 20 centers now around the country legally helping Salvadoran refugees. I think there's one in Seattle. They're down the coast, across through the south, that are helping them with legal support, case by case, helping them with employment, with food, with clothing, shelter. And all of them are lacking for financial support, and congregations can legally support those.
Chicago and Milwaukee are other large centers that have large groups of Salvadoran refugees there that I'm sure need a lot of economic assistance, if nothing else.
I wanted to say one other thing about the law. As I understand it, Dee, you may know it better than I do. We have incorporated into our immigration law the UN definition, the UN Protocol of 1980, which spells out who is a refugee. And a refugee is defined as anyone who has a well-founded fear of persecution if returned to homeland. And certainly that would fit Salvadorans.
That's right.
What happened with that Supreme Court?
But we apply it selectively.
That's right.
We as a government apply it to people who come from countries whose governments we don't currently favor. So we applied it to Cubans right from the beginning, 1960.
Sure.
We've applied it to Poles since Solidarity. We've applied it to other peoples from Eastern Europe as a class. That is, if your nationality is Polish, if you come from Poland, you're automatically treated as a political refugee. We've applied it to Southeast Asians, and later we made them permanent, they could be permanent residents. We've applied it to old Ugandans, you know, people from serious political situations. We've refused it to apply it to self-reliance. And I think it's for a foreign policy reason.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Clearly,
clear.
The State
Department. So the law is not faulty. It's the implementation of the law, which is in the hands of the Attorney General. The Attorney General, who is head of the Department of Justice, can declare that the people from country X are refugees under our law.
As a matter of fact, one of these books, I think, even offers a sample letter that a congregation wrote to the Attorney General of the U.S., stating, you know, this is a position that has been prayerfully taken by our congregation, and these are the reasons why we choose to do this, and we're just notifying you that this is what we're doing. I don't know how large a stack the Attorney General is now collecting of these letters, but again, this has to have an impact. That's a strong statement to make to the Attorney General of the United States, and it's an important. Even if your congregation could do no more than to say it is the position of our congregation that the treatment of refugees from El Salvador is now wrong, we think they ought to be given refugee status which could allow them to remain temporarily here and send that to the Attorney General, that's a strong statement for your congregation to make, and that will have an effect.
Is the Attorney General over the immigration?
Yeah.
Yes.
Part of the Department of Justice.
I was interested to read in the, I think it was last Friday's Wall Street Journal on front page on a conservative Presbyterian church, I think in Ohio, that had tied a can on its pastor for picking up the cause of desegregation earlier, had now voted sanctuary.
Oh. Huh. Interesting. We too can learn from our mistakes, huh? That's pleasant. That's the good news. Yes.
Hey, interesting. We did a forum on this issue last week, and one interesting statistic that was mentioned was that there's about this equal amount of Polish people and Salvadorians coming into the United States asking for refugee status, mm-hmm. or at least declaring refugee status. Mm-hmm. Then it resulted over a 9-month period within the last 12 months, there's 53 Salvadorians and something like 711 Polish people who have been given official uh-huh. status. And I don't only think it's political, I think it's also an ethnic, racial state.
Could be.
I agree. I really think that there are a lot of people in our country, us included, that have a problem feeling compassion for people with darker skins than we do. We can identify with Poles. We have more trouble identifying with Southern Americans. Yes.